Welcome back to the Real Talk with Dana podcast, where we talk all things nutrition, health, fitness, and mindset with a healthy side of sarcasm. I'm your host, Dana Montes of Real Food with Dana. I'm a nutritionist and body image coach, teaching women how to heal their relationship with food and their bodies, ditch the diet cycle for good, and truly thrive with real food, one delicious meal at a time. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Real Talk with Dana podcast. So just a couple of updates before we get started. So you might have noticed I was not posting any of my own content on social media, the podcast, or anything. And instead, I was sharing the voices, experiences, and work of Black activists, creators, educators, body liberation and food justice therapists, dietitians, coaches, and more for the Amplify Melanated Voices Challenge from Black and Embodied and Jessica Wilson. So I would highly recommend you check out that hashtag and those accounts for more information. And I just wanted to say that many people participated in this challenge last week, and there's been a lot more attention on the very pressing racial issues that are going on in this country. And things don't just go back to business as usual, or at least they shouldn't, and they're not going to around here, because we're going to get real here. Things don't go back to normal for the Black community, and going back to business as usual perpetuates the problem, and that's how we got here in the first place. So I just wanted to give you guys a little bit of an update on like what happens for the Instagram, for this podcast, for the brand, for everything. So yes, I'm going to be continuing my content about neutral nutrition, how to improve our body image, our relationship with food, kicking diet culture to the curb so we can live fully and freely as women. I will also be continuing to incorporate anti-racism work that unfortunately only really started last week. And I want to do this to elevate the voices of those whose shoes I can never walk in, supporting Black creators, holding myself accountable for when I make mistakes, because I'm probably going to make mistakes. And I'm trying to educate myself and then share what I'm learning. One of the most impactful quotes that really hit home for me last week was from this woman who's named Ayana, and she's a dietitian, and I'll link her in the show notes because she's amazing. And she had a quote that really spoke to me that said, "There's no dismantling of diet culture without first neutralizing the power structures that undergird the social foundations of white supremacy. Then and only then will we be able to begin the process of rendering diet culture obsolete." And again, I will link her in the show notes because she's amazing. So the point is here that it has to start with that deep work, because we can't fully show up to do this anti-racism essential work in the first place if we're solely focused on shrinking ourselves and fitting into unrealistic societal standards of beauty, of what we should be eating, of what we should be doing, how we should be acting, and how we should be looking as women by the damn patriarchy that happens to be controlled by white supremacy. And we're actually going to be talking about that in today's episode as well. So no, this is not comfortable. It's not comfortable to confront your privilege. It's not comfortable to realize you haven't been doing as much work as you could be to support others in your field who are extremely underrepresented. Like, Black dietitians only represent less than 10% of the members of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. And to support people who are marginalized not only for their body size, but for the color of their skin, which makes it even harder for them to accept their own bodies in a culture that tells them not to. Again, this is not comfortable, but just wanted to let you guys know where I stand and the direction we're going to be going, and there's no going back to normal business as usual after this, because hopefully, we're all evolving and learning from the global trauma of the past couple of weeks and months, and the trauma that's been happening for hundreds of years before my eyes were fully opened. In that same light of dismantling the patriarchy, so today's episode guest is Maho Molfino, and she is the host of the Heroine Podcast, a women's leadership guide, and the author of Break the Good Girl Myth: How to Dismantle Outdated Rules, Unleash Your Power, and Design a More Purposeful Life. So if you like Brené Brown, if you like Glennon Doyle's new book, if you like this self-help work, you are going to freaking love this episode. So Maho is talking about her personal journey of being the good girl, of growing up in an immigrant family, and all of the things that she felt like she had had to be, the standard she had to live up to in order to make her parents' sacrifice worth it for coming to this country. We're talking about what is the patriarchy and what are the patriarchy messengers? What about the good girl myths that shrink us into all of the things that we feel like we should be doing, we should be looking like, all of those things that I mentioned right before this, right? We're also identifying some of the ways that good girl syndrome is inside us all and then what we can do about it. So I know you guys are going to love this episode. I freaking loved it. And Maho has a new book coming out soon. I'm going to link that in the show notes. And yeah, let's dive deep and do the work together. Well, Maho, welcome to the podcast. I'm super excited for you to be here. I'm really excited for all of the listeners to hear exactly what we're going to be talking about, because I feel like this is something that, like a message that everyone really needs to hear, not only all the time, but especially right now with like the turmoil that the world has been in and what's that's making us do as women turn in on ourselves and wonder like, who am I and what am I supposed to be doing and what is my place in the world? So before we get into all that, I would love if you could talk about your personal journey to realizing that you were stuck in playing the role of the good girl and talk about like what that is.
Sure. Well, thanks, Dana, for having me on. I appreciate it. So I am an immigrant. I was born in Argentina. And when I was 2 years old, we left our country. My parents left. And so I grew up away from my roots and my original culture. And my dad was a very ambitious man. So he kept growing in his career. And as a result, we just kept moving. So I never really felt like I had a home or that I belonged in any community or in any culture, right? And I know there are a lot of, maybe you have a few listeners who are daughters of immigrants or who are cross-cultural, they might resonate with this. But as a result, I was kind of always had this question in my mind of like, where do I belong, you know? And I think one of the ways I coped with that core wound was to become a good girl and to really, you know, make my parents proud and pay back their sacrifice, right? That was the mentality that I had. So I got straight A's. I won all the spelling bees and competitions. I did figure skating. I played classical piano. I was every teacher's dream. And you know, I think I was just sort of going along with the program, following the rules, until I left the school system. And in my early 20s, it was time to sort of answer the question of like, well, who am I going to become? What am I going to contribute to society? Like, what do I really care about? And I fell into a big depression and kind of had a crisis moment. I remember I was working in DC and Washington, DC at a health policy organization and looking at myself in the mirror and literally not recognizing myself and feeling like I was wearing a costume. And it was a very pivotal moment where I realized that I had been playing a role up until then. And like a costume, a role is something you can take off. So I like to tell the women I work with, and it's something I say a lot, like we can't break out of the cage. We can't break out of our prison until we see it. You know, I think the first step is really seeing that you're in a cage and the ways that we've built one or the ways society has put one around us. So that was the first aha that I had, and subsequently multiple moments of insight throughout my 20s that really led me to start to deprogram this good girl conditioning that I had picked up.
I think it's so interesting that you say that that happened to you in DC, because that also happened to me when I was living in DC and working in DC. I feel like it's something that kind of happens to a lot of people that work here, is like you grow up and you're like, oh my God, that's the, it's like such a cool place to work. I mean, it's not quite the allure of New York City for a lot of people, right? But it's like a smaller version. And then I feel like it's very easy to lose yourself in that kind of work environment because it's so corporate. It's so like consulting. It's so, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm following the path that's been laid out for me. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with wanting to work in any of the fields that we worked in. I used to work in politics, but you know, if you figure out that it's, you feel like you've been like living a lie your entire life and you're just like, how did I end up here? But then you go through this like identity crisis of, oh God, like who am I and who do I want to be?
Absolutely. Yeah. I remember being in a cubicle and there were these bright fluorescent lights that were so oppressive. And as someone who's highly sensitive and empathic, like my environment really affects me. And I remember wearing sunglasses to work, which is so weird. People thought I was so weird. They're like, why are you wearing sunglasses inside? I'm like, because these lights are oppressing me. But really it was deeper than that. It wasn't just the lights. It was the feeling of being trapped, you know? And I think so many of us feel that. We feel we are trapped and we have to ask ourselves like, well, how much of this is our own creating as well as things we've inherited?
Exactly. So how did you realize when you started to feel this transition period and you mentioned you were feeling really depressed, how were you able to come to the realization of what to pinpoint that on?
Well, you know, I think it was really that, that feeling of understanding I was playing a role and was wearing a costume, but also my relationship to my parents. You know, I think I, at that point I had an aha around like, wow, I'm really terrified of disappointing my family. And as someone who identifies as Latina, you know, our family is everything. Like we're very familial people. And so to break away from familial expectations is a big no-no. So I think I saw myself at that crossroads of, okay, my father is a medical researcher and an MD, wants me to continue down the research path. My parents want me to go get the highest degree of education possible. Yet something doesn't feel right in my bones. You know, something is off. And it's interesting, so many women come to me today where they can't quite pinpoint what they want, but they know what they don't want. So they're like, I don't know what I want yet. I don't know what I have to step into. It's a big unknown. It's a big abyss. But I know I don't want this. I know I don't want to feel trapped. I know I don't want to feel like I have to, I wake up in the morning and I'm really depressed to wake up. I don't feel excited about my day or the work I'm doing. Like, I know I don't want that. And so that's a good starting point, I think, is sort of recognizing what isn't working and what you don't want, because then you can start to go through a process of elimination and iteration, which is a big part of my work because I studied design. I ended up going to school for design, but the idea of course correcting and wayfinding your path is so key. So I think for me, it was really starting to disidentify from being the good daughter. That was the first step.
Awesome. So how did you figure out, and I guess this is like hindsight is 2020, and this is something that you're able to teach your clients now, but what are the different factors at play that do shrink us into believing that we're supposed to be the good girl?
Yeah. So in my book, I talk about the first chapter right away. I was like, I want all of us to get on the same page about what the patriarchy is, right? Because that word is pretty loaded. And, you know, we've learned it, you know, maybe if you took a gender studies class, you know what it is. But like, not a lot of people or women for that matter have taken gender studies classes, right? So do we really know what that is? So like, first, I'm like, let's just lay down the groundwork. Like, what is this system we're born into, right? Like, you're born, you know, you're innocent and you're brilliant and you come out of the womb like a mini goddess, like ready to take on the world. Yet you're born into a system, right? That's already been in there. It's been there since before you got here. So understanding what that is, and the patriarchy has been around for 5,000 years, and it's so deep and it's so ingrained that we don't even see it anymore. It's like the water we're swimming in, the air we're breathing, kind of the way people are now talking about white supremacy. You know, while you and I are having these conversations, there are a lot of race riots going on. Exact same way, these invisible systems that oppress us. And so in the patriarchy, what gets privileged is males over all other genders. And what that creates when you're born into the world as a girl or a woman is you already kind of feel like you're second place, right? You already get a little blow to your worth and self-esteem right out of the get-go, because you're number two, right? And all the messaging that you're receiving from when you're young is about that, about being number two, but also all the messages that you get everywhere about what it means to be a girl and a woman, right? Like every single gender norm that we get from since we are literally 6 months old and beyond, and some even say earlier, when your parents decide to pick pink instead of blue to, you know, decorate your room or whatever. So the reason I'm talking about the patriarchy is, like, I think a lot of us believe that this is some system that's outside of us. And so it's like, oh, it's out there. But what we have to understand is, because we are born into it and we grow up in it, we learn it. And then it gets inside of us. And so what we have to understand is that the patriarchy is inside of us, in the same way that white supremacy is inside of us, right? And so I think that that's the key thing, that when we can be like, okay, all right, how is the patriarchy inside of me? And like, what are the things I've learned about what it means to be a woman? Really, then you start to see the cage, and you can start to take the key out of your pocket and unlock yourself from that cage.
Amazing. Thank you for that explanation. And it's so topical too. You know, like, I love how you mentioned how, you know, we feel like as women, if that's the gender you're assigned at birth, right? Or maybe not assigned, but like, if that's how you're born, and you said, like, when your parents pick blue or pink or, you know, whatever it is. And it's like, you know, bringing race a little bit into the conversation too, is like the patriarchy is like favoring males, but then we go even farther than that. It's like straight white males, right? At the end of the day, that's really what it is. Mm-hmm. And so it's so helpful to think about what you said, is like, we think about this at this, like, as this external thing of the patriarchy, but we've really not only internalized it, but like absorbed it through the systems that we are born into, not intentionally, and maybe not even consciously, like, yes, consciously in some overt examples, but then subconsciously, and it's passed down in all of every single generation from, you know, the beginning of consciousness.
Yes. Yes. And there are four main systems that where we learn, that I call the patriarchy's messengers, right? Cause the thing is like, there's no, even if white males are at the top of the food chain and the system we're born into, I think it's important not to be like, the group of white males over there, they're the enemy, because that's not actually it. You know, it's actually a system that we all perpetuate. It's culture, right? So culture is spread through messages, through rituals, through norms. So it's something that's spread through women too, right? Girls, women, mothers through sisters, daughters, mothers-in-laws. It's perpetuated boys, men. It's perpetuated through all genders. And so, because it's so pervasive. And so I think what I invite my readers and listeners to think about are four main systems. Your family, because that's going to be a main system where you would have gotten messages about what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a girl, what you should be doing and what you shouldn't be doing. So all the rules you inherit from your family, like you said, implicit and explicit. School is a big one. School was a huge one for me. I learned so much about what it means to be a worthy human in from school. Like, you're worthy if you get your gold star and your A+, and if you win the competition. Like, that's what I learned in school. As much as I loved the rich discussions and critical thinking, yada yada, at the end of the day, it was really rewarding me being good and rewarding sciences, right, over arts. Like, so school is also another big one. Religion is a huge, huge system where we learn what we can and can't do as women. And then finally, our larger pop culture, I'll call it Western mainstream culture, sort of the celebrities and the stuff we consume via social media, the movies and music and films we grew up watching, all of that infiltrates our mind. Like, I learned so much about relationships by watching the movies that I watched, you know, being a good girl. You know, I was attracted to a lot of quote unquote bad boy archetypes, right? Why? Because I watched movies like A Walk to Remember, like with Mandy Moore, where, you know, she's the angel and he's the bad boy and she somehow redeems him. But guess what? It doesn't work like that in life. And I got pretty burned, right? But so it's all the messages that we receive that actually don't favor us and don't bring us into authentic relationship and with ourselves and each other. So we got to question all these things, you know, we have to look at them and question them because that's how we're going to grow and how we're going to come into who we're truly meant to be.
Yeah, I love that. And it's so helpful to think about it in that way of all of these shoulds and these external rules that we're imposing upon ourselves from family, school, religion, and like the Western mainstream culture, instead of relying on intuitive and internal knowing, right? As like Glennon Doyle says, it's like, go be still and know, right? Like, talk mm-hmm. about the knowing. And but we're also taught from, and mainly my work is in, you know, food and exercise and like dismantling diet culture and stuff like that. And we're taught that our bodies and our intuition can't be trusted. And I feel like it's the same way with all of these four categories, as we're continuously told, this is how you should behave. This is how you should dress. This is how you should look. This is what you should do. And when we have a disconnect with that, like you experienced in your 20s, like I experienced in my 20s, like so many people experience, or women definitely experience at some point in their lives, is like, this just doesn't feel right, but am I allowed to do anything about it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I love that you brought that up. What you just reminded me of is what I call the good girl myth of logic. So I propose there are 5 good girl myths, and we just went over the myth of rules. But what you're sort of tying to when you're talking about intuition and in the way that I've framed it, particularly in my book, is yes, we're born in a system that really values mind over body, logic and reason over intuition. And that is of great detriment to girls and women, because we get cut off from one of our greatest sources of intelligence, which is our bodies and our intuition. Because all the messages we're getting is, you know, we can't trust our bodies. We have to trust the mind, and we have to trust what is the logical next step. What is the safe next step? What is the thing that we're supposed to do? So in the book, I talk about 5 good girl myths, but they're all interconnected. And I see the myth of rules and the myth of logic as sort of playing off each other. So I'm really glad you brought that up, because it's a big one. And it's something that I actually grapple with a lot. My primary good girl myth is the myth of perfection. And the second one is the myth of logic. It's something that to this day, I have to remind myself to take care of the body first, right? because I just want to feed the mind. Like I wake up and I'm like ready to feed my mind. I'm like, what information can I consume? What can I learn? What, you know, how can I just like be, you know, stimulate my intellect and go, go, go. And then to be able to ask myself in the morning, what does your body need first? Has been a revolutionary act for me. It's like, oh, I need water. I need to eat. I need to breathe. And so I think we're all in a process of, it's a revolutionary, radical act to prioritize the body's intelligence.
Definitely. And it's so interesting that you bring that up too, because I've talked with some past guests about the like masculine versus feminine energies, right? And when you think about the traditional masculine energy, it's like doing and like logic over intuition and feelings and emotions and everything like that. And when we go back to the different messengers that you were talking about, when we look especially at school, we think about, oh, we're taught logic. And when we're little girls, they're like, oh, we want you to be smart and we want you to do this. And then you look at mainstream culture and it's like, oh, girls with feelings are crazy. And so we suppress those in order to try and be that smart girl and like be the super intellectual or like get the highest degree like your parents wanted to do for you. And we have this like disconnect between those masculine and feminine energies, and they become so out of balance that we become so driven that we then don't even know how to process our feelings and lose touch with that intuition.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up feelings. That's huge, because that's exactly what we get into when we haven't learned how to, when we haven't learned how to be in touch with our bodies, we end up numbing our feelings. And I'm sure because of the work you do, you see so much around this, right? How much our relationship with food, whether it's wanting to under or overeat, has to do with numbing some feeling inside of us. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I feel that that is key, like us as women being able to reclaim our feelings and allowing ourselves to feel whatever we want to feel is huge. And so in the book, I talk a lot about what does that look like, the intuition coming into being mindful about our feelings, processing emotions, either through expression or release or sitting with them. That's a big piece of unlearning this good girl conditioning around logic that we've inherited from the patriarchy.
And then, so you mentioned there are five. We've talked about rules, we've talked about logic and perfection or perfectionism. What are the other two?
The other two are harmony and sacrifice. And I do want to make a quick note with these good girl myths. I developed these because there are patterns I saw in sort of, okay, how does this internalized patriarchy express itself? And I was like, wow, it expresses itself in these five core ways, these five self-sabotaging tendencies, often subconscious. Women don't realize they're playing out in their lives, in their relationships, in their career, in their well-being. So the five good girl myths are rules, perfection, logic, harmony, and sacrifice. And I just want to point out that none of these qualities are actually bad. You know, there are contexts and situations in which we want harmony and in which we want sacrifice. But what I'm saying and what I argue through the book is that when you're in a good girl role, and when you're in your good girl conditioning, often when it's subconscious, you default to these good girl myths. And so it becomes the default and you don't even realize you're doing it. And when it becomes the default, it's the invisible force that is actually creating these negative consequences in your life and creating these problems. And so it's important just to note that what we want to do is bring these into balance, right? And so for each good girl myth, there is a strategy for approval. And then there is what you want to, the powers you want to reclaim and integrate when you bring that quality into balance.
I really like how you bring up that these are kind of our defaults. And we could even go so far to say it's like a default coping mechanism. And before we started recording, we had talked about how a lot of people during the time of quarantine, or now that there's been a lot of like racial tensions and everything that's going on, people are defaulting to their habitual coping mechanisms or their habitual ways of dealing with things, which sounds like it can be any of these five things.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because that's exactly what the good girl archetype is. I define it as an armor or a mask. It's a protective mechanism. So when you say protective mechanism, that makes me think of coping, right? That helps us feel safe and loved in the patriarchy, but is ultimately disempowering. So we inhabit the five good girl myths because we believe that's going to allow us to be safe and loved. And we align with the patriarchy that way. But actually, in the end, it's disempowering for us to be defaulting into perfection, rules, harmony, logic, and sacrifice.
Yeah. And this comes up so, so much when we're talking about body image and dieting and relationship with food. We think manipulating our bodies and doing that via food and exercise and all of these like so-claimed health trends are going to fix us and make us more lovable and make us more likely to have belonging and worthiness, when really they're all so disempowering because, again, we're relying on these external rules and these systems that we've grown up in that told us this is how we are supposed to be, this is what you should look like and you should do, but you're losing yourself in the process.
100%. 100%. And that's the sacrifice. That's the question that I ask so many clients too, is what's the trade-off you're making, right? What's the impact and trade-off you make when you follow rules or when you follow harmony or when you follow sacrifice? Because there's always a cost. And sometimes the cost is subtle and invisible, but you have to look at it because the price is steep. And so, because you get short-term gain, from being harmonious in this defaulting into being harmonious in this relationship, because maybe you don't have to deal with conflict. But what is the price long-term? What is the price long-term you're giving up? That relationship is obviously going to erode over time because you're not speaking up and speaking your truth. So harmony is like a whole thing we can dig into. It's a really big one. And it's one that I really, really feel like we're beginning to overcome as women. We've seen it with the Me Too movement. We're seeing it now. I think Black women and women of color are leading the way for a lot of us in how we can totally break this good girl myth of harmony. There's just too much at stake when we are keeping quiet. Too much at stake.
I love that. Yeah, let's definitely dig into harmony. And it's interesting because, you know, we look at these other ones like rules and perfection and sacrifice, and we're like, okay, I can identify that those could be problematic. But just from the title of harmony, you wouldn't assume that that mm-hmm. would actually be a problem that could erode you from the inside.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I used the word harmony because I couldn't find any other word. Because ultimately, we want harmony in our lives. We want harmony between within ourselves and with our environment and with each other and on the planet. So I'm pro-harmony. I want you all to know that. However, in the framework of the five good girl myths and my book, the myth of harmony is its own little beast, and I'll share what it is. It sounds like this. If I just go with the flow and avoid being difficult, there won't be any problems. It looks like the tendency to seek and keep harmony instead of embracing the conflict and confrontation needed for change. What's the main strategy for approval? You're easy to get along with, you're pleasant, you're likable. But what are the powers that you give up and need to reclaim for yourself? Your voice and your truth. So the best example I give of harmony is I had this awful ex-boyfriend, and when we were dating, he was very big into tattoos, and he was like, hey, I want you to get a tattoo with my initials on it, because he always had this like weird feeling that maybe I wouldn't love him forever. He was one of those bad boy archetypes that I like got burned by. And so I was like, all right, you know, naive and innocent. I was like, okay, harmonious. Yeah, honey. Like, I didn't want to cause any problems. I was already fighting with him a lot. So I kind of was just like, all right, I'm not going to resist this. Let's go get a tattoo. And I thought, you know, I did a little bit of research, went to the tattoo parlor, and the tattoo artist had another appointment. It was like we did a drop-in. And so she sketched something in a hurry. And she showed it to me. Like, she sketched it in like 5 minutes. But this is a tattoo that's going to be on my body for the rest of my freaking life. She sketched in like 5 to 10 minutes and showed it to me. And because I was under the myth of harmony, I know it sounds crazy, but every woman knows this feeling. I was like, yeah, that looks nice. You know, like, that looks good, you know? And then my ex-boyfriend, or my boyfriend at the time, he decided, you know what, I'm going to go get tatted up myself. So he left me to go get tattooed himself. And I was like, okay. And that would have been the time for me to be like, no, please stay with me. Like, I need you to be here with me. This is my first tattoo. I'm scared. Blah, blah. But I didn't. And so what happened? I kept my voice inside. This is a small example, but you could think of other examples where the stakes are even higher. And now I have a tattoo on my body for the rest of my life that I don't like because I didn't actually speak up. And so it's an example, you know, and I've done a lot of inner work to reclaim that tattoo and change my relationship to it. I took off his initials and et cetera. But when I think back at that time, I think about all the the little incidents too. You're at a massage, you know, have you ever gotten a massage and the massage therapist is like, oh, make sure you know, tell me if I'm pressing too hard. How many of us actually don't tell them and we just stay quiet, you know? We don't actually speak up and say, actually, yeah, that's too hard, you know, because we're just like, oh, I just don't really want to say anything. I don't feel like it, you know? And so it's just, it's the little things that add up. And then it's practicing in those little contexts and situations with the masseuse, with your partner, and then in big ways, like standing up to racism, right? And standing up to sexism. Like, it's all on a spectrum, but it's the same muscle.
Yeah. Yep. And it sounds a lot like when we're talking about the myth of harmony, that it would play like perfectly into the myth of sacrifice as well.
Yep. Those two play really well, kind of like logic and rules play together. Those two are more associated with, you know, stereotypically masculine qualities. Harmony and sacrifice are playing into the gender norm of femininity more. And so, yeah. They do. So women who score, there's an assessment you can take if you buy the book, and there you'll find out what your primary myth is, your secondary myth is. And what I found, that a lot of women who score high on harmony also score on sacrifice, that they are coupled together because maybe this woman felt the pressure to fulfill the sort of gender norms of being feminine that are spelled out by society.
Right. And it's like, you're supposed to, again, with the shoulds, right? You're supposed to be supermom, but you're supposed to put everyone's needs before your own. It's like the highest calling of a woman is to be like selfless, basically, but then to lose yourself in the process, like, really?
Oh my God. Oh, the myth of sacrifice. It's like the roots of that myth is like, it's so multi-generational. It's the one good girl myth that I feel like is passed down from grandmother to mother to daughter, like through the matrilineal line mostly. Because it's how the women in our families modeled themselves. Right. And so we have been given so many examples of like a virtuous woman. Like, I think it's even written in the Bible, like a virtuous woman is a woman who like pretty much takes the clothes off her back and gives it, you know, and is the woman who sacrifices and toils day and night for the poor and her family. And it's like this really long description. I almost included the verse in the book, but I decided not to, but, yeah, it's one that I would say we see modeled to us through family and mainstream pop culture, but also religion. So So it's a biggie. We got to learn how to unlearn that one and learn that it, when we choose ourselves first, we're not being selfish. You know, I think that's a big fear that so many of us have. Like, if I choose who I really want to be with, or if I choose the career I really want to do, or if I choose the art I really want to make, or if I take this time for myself the way I really want to, if I honor my desire, I am being a selfish woman, you know? And, you know, I think Glennon Doyle talks about that. This boils down to all the way back to the myth of Eve and eating the apple. It's like desire equals selfish. And so I think we have been programmed to put other people's desires before our own. And so one of the things I really encourage women to do is take back their time and energy, because those are the two main things. In the myth of sacrifice, those are the two main things you need to take back for yourself. Those are your resources, your time and your energy. And one way to reclaim your time is to move from a reactive time orientation to a responsive time orientation. And reactive time orientation is when basically, you know, your phone is your notification. You don't have any boundaries with your phone. Like, anyone can call you or text you at any time. You'll respond right away. Your door to your office or bedroom is left wide open. People can pretty much take time from you whenever they need it, right? And that's a reactive time orientation, versus a responsive time orientation is when you have engagements in place. You have an orientation of what you're going to do with your time. So people can't just take. Because in our roles, I'm going on a rant right now, but in our roles as mother, daughter, sister, people want to take our time. They do. Like, they, you know, they need us. They want us. And so we need to learn how to have those healthy boundaries around our time and our calendar. So having a responsive time orientation is really big, really big. Prioritize your deep work, your self-care. Prioritize those, I would say, those two main things. What's your purpose work and what's your self-care? Those two things really need a slot into your calendar before anything else. And then you're really asking whether this engagement makes sense for you from a place of responsiveness and not reactivity.
Yeah, and I would bet that this one in particular is so hard for women, because not only are we told that we should be selfless and we should put everyone's needs before our own, but then people who follow that, and a lot of people, right, feel that they get value and they like being needed and they get fulfillment from doing things for other people, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But if that's the only way that you get value, by feeling valued and feeling needed and doing things for other people, and you're sacrificing yourself in the process, your self-worth and your health is also going to go.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up. But the thing about that is that what I would say is that helper tendency has been trained in you. Like, if you have that helper tendency, that's something that's been trained in you over multiple years. Like, when you helped people out as a girl or a woman, you got patted on the head and told, good girl, thank you, you're needed, you're valued, you're loved. And so it's something that you learned that was trained. And the good news about that is it's something you can untrain and unlearn, start to decouple. Because I have that exact same thing, but I have that with work. So, because my good girl myth is perfection, I'm a high achiever. And so I've attached my worth to my work, right? And that was also trained in me through schooling and through gold stars and grades. And so learning to uncoil that is my work. And so what you're talking about is that helper tendency, which is for women who have the good girl myth of sacrifice, their work is to really uncoil that, decouple their worth, exactly as you just said, from other people's needs, desires, neediness.
Yeah, exactly. So since the book isn't out yet and people don't have it in their hands, right? So how, before the book came out or comes out, right? Because it's coming out soon. How have you been able to help women realize, like, what is the main thing that's holding them back, and then how they can not only identify what their power is, but how they can reclaim it?
Yes. So I think, like I said in the beginning of the conversation, seeing the cage is like half the battle. So understanding what your primary good girl myth is, what your secondary one is, what your unique good girl formula is, huge. Doing the reflection prompts around the four systems I talked about, right? Family, religion, pop culture, and school. Really digging into that, because that's when you start seeing and you start making invisible rules visible. So that's all the awareness work we need to do. And then in terms of solutions, they depend on your good girl myth. But one of the main solutions that I propose in the book is one that has really helped me in unlearning my good girl conditioning. And it's something that I think is really unique. And that's why I really wanted to share it, is around what I've learned as a designer. So what's beautiful about design is it's very creative. It's a creative field, but it also is also a nice balance. There's also analysis. So it's like it strikes a nice integration and balance between creativity and analysis. But with design, what I have learned is how to build creative confidence and self-worth, particularly in allowing myself to be messy and make mistakes and be wrong and prototype. And so I think the key thing I've learned in design thinking and the design process is being how to be imperfect and how to see everything I do, a relationship, a career move, even a well-being ritual or a food, a meal, as a prototype, right? As something that's in process and something that I'm still learning and growing. So prototyping is a big, big part of how we can unlearn, particularly the good girl myth of perfection. And then I've sprinkled design thinking solutions throughout all of the myths. So for sacrifice, I share how design thinking can support you in taking back your calendar and having boundaries around your energy. For harmony, I talk about how design is particularly good in learning how to give and receive feedback, because that's what designers have to do in their creative work all the time. And that's what's so important in you freeing up your voice, is both maturing in your relationships, is learning the art of giving and receiving feedback. Because what's happening right now, since you're releasing this tomorrow, I can just say it, a lot of white women are having difficulty receiving feedback from Black women and women of color. And so they're getting defensive and they're getting fragile. But and so part of that issue is also is the myth of harmony. They believe that that true progress happens through, let's all just get along and be, and like, you know, we don't want anger here. We don't want any difficult emotions here. Let's just speak with civility. You know, this is what you might hear a white woman say, and you'd be like, wait a second. Wait a second. I think we need emotions like anger, and we need to hear the difficult feedback from women of color and Black women who are like, this isn't working and it hasn't been working for a long time and you all are just waking up to it. So our ability to receive feedback is something that is an open state, which we learn from a creative process, right? Through creativity. So my work is very intersectional, as you can already tell. I'm intersecting design thinking and creativity with feminism, which is a big part of why I think what I'm offering is different and unique, because, you know, I haven't seen it done before. And it's really my unique perspective as a designer, as someone who really believes in the power of creativity and the power of being open to really change our lives, because so much of conditioning is narrow thinking and being in a box and being closed.
It is. And it's such a fresh new creative way of thinking about things, right? And it's interesting because, you know, you mentioned some of your main myths were like the rules and the logic and the perfection. And now you've been able to like break out of that into your more creative side to bring it into this kind of intersectional feminism in this way of teaching women how they can not only break free of the myths, but reclaim their power and figure out how they want to be creative and how they can show up in the world to tune into that intuition without having to follow these external rules that we've internalized from the patriarchy for generations.
Absolutely. I can't even begin to tell you, Dana, how many women are sitting on brilliant ideas for weeks, months, years, lifetimes. They might, and so much energy is locked up because we are following good girl conditioning. So if there's a woman who's listening to this right now, if you're a woman who's listening to this right now and you have an idea or a dream for your life that you've been thinking about and sitting on for weeks, months, or years, right? I want you to ask yourself, how am I following one of these good girl myths? Because it's there. The answer is there. Am I following the good girl myth of rules? Am I following the good girl myth of perfection, logic, harmony, or sacrifice? Which of these five is really getting in the way? And we all have all five of the good girl myths, but one or two are pretty dominant. So really being able to ask yourself, and if you want, take the assessment in the book to understand what's getting in the way of you sharing your gifts. Because ultimately, that's what I care about. I want to activate women to share their gifts.
Yes, I love that.
You know, and get their voice and perspective out. Because like this, we want this world to be co-designed, right? We want diversity and inclusion in designing the future of this world. Otherwise, we're going to see the same, same. So we need more women to contribute. And in order to do that, you have to look deep within and unroot all these, you know, multi-generational conditioning that's been there.
I love that. So speaking of books, one question that I love to ask my guests is, aside from yours, obviously, which I would love to have you talk about after you answer this question, but what is one book that you think everyone should read in addition to your own?
I love Self-Compassion by Kristen Neff. That's because my good girl myth is perfection. Self-compassion is my like medicine, right? It's like, I like need that more than anything. Every day I need to give myself a dose of self-compassion. So Self-Compassion by Kristen Neff, she's a professor, University of Texas, Austin. She's done a lot of incredible research on the power of self-compassion and how self-compassion is almost a better intervention than self-esteem. And her work is amazing. So highly recommend that.
She has a great also self-compassion quiz on her website too that I can link to in the show notes if anyone is interested. So speaking of that,
so good.
We've been talking about your book, but tell people like when it's coming out, where they can get it, all that kind of good stuff.
Sure. So my book's called Break the Good Girl Myth, How to Dismantle Outdated Rules, Unleash Your Power, and Design a More Purposeful Life. And you can find it on goodgirlmyth.com. Just one word, goodgirlmyth.com. And if you order before the book is officially published, so if you pre-order before July 28th, you'll also get a free training, which is going to support you in designing your creative purpose, which is what we were just talking about, like really getting that dreamer idea out into the world.
Amazing. So thank you so, so much for coming on. I cannot wait to release this for people, obviously, because it's coming out so soon. So tell people where they can find you all of the places.
Sure. So I'm on Instagram at my name, Maho Molfino, Maho spelled with a J. And are you going to link to this in show notes as well? Okay. Just because of spelling reasons, I think it should check that out. So, you know, cause my name is Argentinian. So it's, so if you're not Spanish speaking, it may be hard to know. So Maho Molfino. My website is mahomolfino.com, but if you go to goodgirlmyth.com, it'll just direct you to my website.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing and thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Dana, for all the work you're doing. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk with Dana. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your family and friends and share the love by throwing us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, which will help spread the word and do a small part to correct all of the fitness and nutrition misinformation or bullshit that's out there, which is only causing people to become more unhealthy. Come find me anywhere at Real Food with Dana on Instagram and Facebook. Join the Real Talk with Dana Facebook group for more support and discussion on these episodes, and come hang out over on realfoodwithdana.com for the show notes and totally epic and delicious recipes.